The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating over 50 years of promoting greater awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. This podcast is brought to you through the generous financial support of the Tongyang Group. In the areas of financial services and manufacturing, the companies of the Tongyang Group harness the passion and creativity of 12,000 employees worldwide to better serve their clients. The Tongyang Group, a global partner for Korean business.
On May 7th, 2009, Cecilia Hae-jin Lee, author of Eating Korean, From Barbecue to Kimchi, Recipes from My Home, visited the Korea Society to speak about her latest cookbook, Quick and Easy Korean Cooking. Lee is also the author of several travel guides, and her writing has been featured in Food and Wine, Eating Well, The Los Angeles Times, The Washington Post, The Whole Life Times, The Asian Pacific American Journal, and Korean Culture Magazine.
Well, first of all, thank you for coming here and accepting to do this interview, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much.
Visually very striking, actually. The first thing that caught my attention was actually the photographs. The pictures were quite nice, and I found it a little unusual. And actually, you know, the first time I came across your book was at the MoMA, and there's not many books at the MoMA on Korean cuisine.
Yeah. I'm surprised it's at MoMA.
And that's one of them.
Really?
So I thought that was definitely very interesting. So it's actually your second book?
It's my third book, actually.
Third book on Korean.
It's my second cookbook. My second book was The Former South Korea Guide, the travel guide.
Mm-hmm. And you want to talk about your first book, Eating Korean, and how this one relates to your first one, how different it is.
Sure. My first book, Eating Korean, was a memoir cookbook. So it was personal stories with family photos mixed in with my family recipes. And the biggest complaint I got from it was, where are the pictures? And I was like, I wanted to print color photos, but it would have been too expensive for my publisher. So I thought, whatever cookbook I do next, I want to make sure there's pictures of the food so people can know what it's supposed to look like. Mm-hmm. So I also wanted to make it more accessible for people who aren't Korean or who haven't had Korean food, so they can go, oh, I could try this. This looks easy. I can do it. So that's why I wrote this book.
So then that first book, it was a mixture of personal anecdotes and recipes, how they related to your childhood. So for you, food, so to speak, is associated with your Korean childhood, growing up in a grocery store, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, my parents owned a Mexican grocery store. They still do, actually. Yeah, so I'm actually writing a Mexican cookbook right now. That's my next book. But for our family, I mean, cooking and eating is just a big deal. And we're like the only people I think I know that while we're eating dinner, we'll talk about breakfast the next day, you know, while we're in it. It's like talking about the next two meals ahead while we're eating the one meal now. So it's like our family is really into eating. And so food and cooking was a big part of my life growing up.
So unfortunately, I think lots of people are still not very familiar with Korean cuisine, Korean food. What would you say is the big difference between Korean food compared with Chinese and Japanese? By now, Chinese and Japanese food are almost mainstream. I'm not sure. Maybe I'm going a little far here. What would you say is the defining trait of Korean food, and how different is it from Chinese and Japanese?
Well, most people, if they've had Korean food in a restaurant, their first introduction is barbecue, which is good, but barbecue actually started as a restaurant food, and it's not home cooking because meat isn't big in Korean cooking. It's mostly seafood and vegetables because that's what people ate. But Korean food is different in that it's seasonal and everything is... I'm trying to figure out the best way to explain it. Mm-hmm. Korean food is seasonal, and there's a lot of seafood involved because Korea is a peninsula. But unlike Japanese food, which is more about very subtle flavors, Korean food has very, very strong flavors. big spicy things, lots of garlic, chili paste, you know, sesame oil, soy sauce and things like that, salted fish, you know, things like that. And then Chinese food uses, I think, a little more oil. It's a lot of wok cooking or sautéing. And Korean food is a little lighter and healthier than that. So it's different in that way.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that reflects a national temperament? You just said you thought maybe Japanese food tends to be more around the nuance, the subtle. I suppose right. Some critics could say bland, depending on the perspective. On the other hand, Koreans yes. are more. Do you think that's a reflection of the national temperament? Are Koreans spicier? I think
in a way. One time I was in Korea, and I actually took a boat to Japan. Mm-hmm. And it was very different because I forgot that, because, you know, everyone looks very similar because we come from very similar genetic backgrounds. But the Japanese are so much more polite and more reserved and quieter. And you go to Korea and it's just noisy and people are just in your face. And, you know, just like it is a little bolder. I think Korean personality is that way. And it reflects in the food.
What about Korean Chinese? Can you go back to that comparison a little more?
How do I compare the Chinese?
If you could draw, I don't know, a line between Korean and Chinese food.
It's very different. I think all Asian food sort of derived from Chinese food in the beginning. Uh-huh. So like, you know, the Korean kimchi came from Chinese pickling, but then we wanted to add garlic and chili pepper, which, you know, the Chinese don't do when they're pickling. So things right. like that. So it's sort of, in some ways, it's a starting point for Korean cuisine, but then we take it much farther and go, okay, we're going to just make it even crazier and add more spices and make it, you know, bolder and stronger in flavor.
So as a chef, as a cook, what would be the, what are the key ingredients that you would keep in your kitchen at all time?
At all times.
The key ingredients of Korean food, like the...
Yes. See, I always have dried anchovies. Little tiny fish called myeolchi. And you've got to have a couple different kinds of those. They come in all these different sizes. And I always have soy sauce, of course, the good stuff. And sesame oil, but you have to get the toasted sesame oil. That's, if you can see through the bottle, it's not good. It has to be opaque, and it has to be strong and have good flavor. And you have to have garlic, because you can't do without garlic.
You can't do anything without garlic. Right.
And chili paste, because chili paste is good for making dipping sauces or spicing up your barbecue or things like that. And sesame seeds.
Sesame seeds.
Because Koreans, for some reason, sprinkle everything with sesame seeds as a garnish. And it's like, oh, make it look better. Just put sesame seeds on it. So
your book is called Quick and Easy Korean Cooking. Does that mean... it's normally slow and difficult. For example, like typically, when you go to a Korean food tasting, they give you japchae, and that takes forever. This is actually really long.
That's the myth.
Is it a prejudice?
Yeah, I think the myth about Korean food is that, oh, you have to make, like things like kimchi, which is, you know, people are like, oh, you make it, it takes forever, and you have to bring like 50 women to make it, and then you bury it in the snow, and then it ferments for months in the winter. It doesn't have to be that way, and that's why I really wanted to make sure that people knew that Korean food isn't that difficult, that it's not always slow and difficult, that it can be quick and easy. So what I did was I actually set a timer every time I tried a recipe and made sure that every recipe took less than 30 minutes of work time. So if it took longer, I'll be like, okay, I got to figure out a way to make this faster without, you know, compromising on flavor.
Yeah, that's what I particularly liked about it, because usually, you know, the dosage is a little a bit on the impressionistic side sometimes.
Right.
You get a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And that brings me to another question. Koreans often say that good taste comes from, and there's a Korean expression for that, which I think is sunmat.
Sunmat, your mother's hand taste.
Your mother's hand taste.
That's right. That's the direct translation.
That's an interesting expression.
Right.
So first of all, yeah, what do you think of this expression in the first place? And do you think you can create... Do you think you can have this Korean quality sunmat, your mother's hand taste, for lack of a better translation,
right.
by simply following the recipe and the rules that would be written in your book?
Well, I think that food is is based on, you know, sharing and about eating together and eating with family and friends and things like that. So if you ate it alone, it's not going to taste the same as if you have it with family and friends. Mm-hmm. And so, if somebody makes you something, I think the sort of care and, you know, time they took to make it reflects in the food. And it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, oh, they took 3 days to make this thing to, you know, make it taste good in some ways. And some of it has to do with, like, instead of mixing it with a spoon, mix it with your hands so you get the feel for the food. Uh-huh. So if you're, you know, marinating the barbecue, you do it with your hands instead of using a fork or spoon or something like that. So I think that makes a big difference. It's just getting really into having a little more familiarity with the food.
So these days, Korean food is becoming more popular. I see a few more books out there popping up. Your book, of course.
I'm trying to make it more popular.
You're trying to make it popular.
Yes.
At the same time, it seems to me, and then again, maybe it's just my own idea of it and completely wrong, Korean food has changed a bit in the past few years, and you see a trend, especially if you go back to Korea, mm-hmm. towards fusion, and I think it's actually a global trend. Like most national cuisine these days chef incorporates other elements from Japanese, from French, of course, is always somewhere in the background. So what do you think about this tendency towards fusion, if that's an accurate description of what's happening?
Well, when I was younger, mm-hmm. I used to hate fusion for like, oh, that's terrible, it's not authentic. But as I got older, I appreciate sort of the globalization of food in general, because mm-hmm. I think food is a reflection of culture, and culture is getting globalized all over because of the way people travel and information is shared. And so, you know, I mean, I grew up putting kimchi on our pizzas, and we always put kimchi in our stuffing for Thanksgiving, kimchi hamburgers. And so it's sort of like, you know, because you can't have enough kimchi in anything. So, and so we, in a way, I was like, I used to be down on fusion food, but then I was like, well, I made fusion food and didn't even think about it, because mm-hmm. I would just mix Korean things with having uh-huh. grown up in America, but having been born in Korea, I mixed it up anyway. Uh-huh. And so the last time I was in Korea, uh-huh. I did see that happening more and more. And I think it's exciting, actually.
Yeah. So you think fusion is just a spontaneous thing, and your natural people are naturally these days pretty supposed to mix?
I think fusion works best when you don't dilute the two things or the three or whatever comes in to fuse together. I think it works best when you take the best parts of the different cultures and mix it up together, and the best parts of the flavors without diluting it. I think that's the best way. Uh-huh.
So you're basically, what would you say to a guy who would tell you, let's say somebody who's a little conservative, and you know, God knows Koreans can be conservative
yes.
sometimes,
true.
Open your book and tell you, why not? But this is not really Korean, is it? What would you say to that? Oh, some particular, I don't have a particular dish in mind, but.
Well, there's some things like, you know, for instance, fried chicken. Fried chicken is not traditional Korean, but it got, you know, KFC and, you know, fried chicken got imported to Korea. And so the Koreans, you know, made it their own. So instead of having just fried chicken, they have to put, you know, chili paste on it and mm-hmm. season it and sprinkle it with sesame seeds and things like that. Mm-hmm. And the same with pizza in Korea. They'll bring in pizza, but they have to serve it with, you know, kimchi and things like that. So I wouldn't say my book is, you know, traditional, you know, mm-hmm. but I would say it's authentic in the way that it does retain the authentic Korean flavors.
Uh-huh. Since you're in New York, what do you think about the New York Korean food scene?
Every time I come to New York, people want to take me to eat Korean food. And I'm like, I get enough of it at home. Why do you want to take me to a Korean restaurant? But I think it's getting more and more developed and more interesting mm-hmm. as time goes on. But I have to say, I'm a little biased. I think LA has the best Korean food.
Yeah, so that I saw the recommendations of a Korean restaurant. I kind of want to try that now when I travel to LA often. You have a question?
I think you may have touched on this before, okay. that you know Korean food is very seasonal. So maybe, and that's always been the impression that's given me. Maybe you can walk us through the cycle of the seasons and
sure.
the dishes that go with the different seasons.
Okay.
So if we start right now, we're entering into summer. So what would be a summertime?
Okay, for the summertime, well, Korean food seasonal because it had to be seasonal. because, you know, it is a very farm-oriented society for a really long time, and it's only been developed and modern in the last few decades. So I actually remember how it was when I was growing up there in the 70s. And you go to the market and you get whatever is available at the market, and that's what you make for dinner. And so for the summertime, it would be, you know, gosh, whatever's growing in the... I'm trying to think what grows in the summer. The one thing that Koreans do in the summertime is what they call fighting fire with fire. Mm-hmm. So if it, so it's really hot and very humid. So when it's the hottest day of the year, you eat really hot soup. So you take the young chicken and you boil it, you know, for a long time, stuff it with rice and dates and garlic, and then you make a soup, and then that's what you're sweating, and that's you're just fighting off the heat with the heat. So there's that, and then they go to the sauna. I mean, my dad does that. He'll go to the sauna in the summertime. I'm like, what, are you crazy? You know? So there's a fire with fire thing. And then in the fall is the best time of year because all the vegetables and all the harvest is ready. The rice is fresh. It's the best time to get rice. And then that's when everybody takes the vegetables and make kimchi. And that's for preserving the vegetables over the winter because it's very cold and snowy and wintry because of the winds from Siberia come down and cover Korea. So then you make kimchi to last you through the winter time so that you have some kind of vegetable to eat. But in the winter, you have root vegetables as well as kimchi and, you know, salted preserved things. And then in the spring, then it's the new shoots. So, you know, like new things that are growing, and it's fresh young vegetables like green onions and perilla leaves and things like that that are just starting to come out.
Mm-hmm. I noticed another thing in Korean food that at least it's been my experience. Food is never just food.
No.
This is good for this, and this is good for...
Right. It's true. It'd be like, you're having a baby? You've got to have, like, all this seaweed soup. And it's like, okay, the baby's going to come out green with how much seaweed soup you're giving me. But it's like, okay, that's what you got to have. Or it's like, oh, you have a cold, you have to have, you know, soybean sprout soup, and that's going to help you because of garlic and the chili pepper. So it's all about sort of... I guess food is really about... a way of life. And even as in Korea, the greeting for seeing people is not, you don't say hello, you say, have you eaten? You know, that's what you say. And so
much like the Chinese.
Yeah, the Chinese do that as well. They're, have you eaten? And in some ways it's because Korea was a poor society. And so you wanted to make sure if a guest came to your house that they had eaten, so that they wouldn't leave your house hungry. But also that's just part of the society, I think. And people love food. You know, Koreans love their food.
So you think getting to know Korean, related to that, getting to know Korean cuisine, Korean food is a good way to know the culture as well?
I think any introduction to a culture, the best way to know it, other than the language, is by food. Because even if you can't speak the language and you can't even communicate, you can still share food together with people. And it's a good way of understanding and getting introduced to the culture.
Do you find this agricultural cycle, which has lost the people now who live in cities, is maintained through eating food at different times, or that memory of being an agricultural society is kept in the food?
I think yes, that there is still memory for agriculture because it there's still the Korean holidays are based around agriculture, so. You know, there's the springtime, you know, just when after the first, you know, 21 days of winter or whatever it is. And then you have to eat a certain food for that time of year. And then, you know, there's a summer, you eat a certain type of food for that time of year. And then in the fall, which is, you know, you have the harvest festival and then you go and eat a certain type of food during the year. So in some ways, with the modernized society, people living in the cities, there is a little bit more distance. Mm-hmm. But I also think that because it's so ingrained in the culture that you can't really lose it, and people don't know why they're doing it, but they continue to do it anyway.
So is in that sense, is your book for busy, and it's quick and easy again? So it's for city people. And would you have any quick tips then for city people who don't want to spend too much time on cooking but are craving Korean food? You know,
they have a specific... I always say, first thing you do, put on a pot of rice. because once the rice is cooking, then everything else can come afterwards. Uh-huh. So you put on the pot of rice, and hopefully you have a rice cooker. And even if you don't, you could do it on the stove. And then you just saute whatever you're going to do or cook whatever you're going to do. And then I could actually make a meal in 30 minutes, but, you know, most people can do it in about, you know, 45 minutes because we're busy people. We have, you know, children and jobs, and who wants to spend a lot of time making dinner?
Right.
You know, when you get home from work.
Maybe that's the sad thing about it. Yeah. I really did think it took a long time to do japchae, though. I've seen people take, maybe they were just very
Have you slow. Tried my recipe?
No. Okay. I don't cook. I'm sorry.
Oh, you should, like, no, then you should really try it. People who don't cook should try it.
Yeah, I should. I've been tempted lately, but it's just I've seen a couple of times some of my friends make japchae. Mm-hmm. I was shocked at how much time it took. I was feeling really sorry. So with all the chopping.
Yeah, well, the shortcut I use is that I cook everything in the same frying pan and I mix it all in the same bowl.
Oh, I see.
So, you know, maybe the fewer dishes, the better, I always say. Well, I don't worry about it because my husband does the dishes, but...
Wow. That helps.
Yes, that does help. And I make a big mess. But I try to make things so that the fewer dishes you have to use, the better it is and the faster it is. So the japchae, usually it's a lot of cutting and all of that. Just cut it up, have it all ready, and then saute it all, toss it, it's done.
Great.
Yeah.
Should try it. Make sure everyone's fine.
In your introduction, you talk about how learning to cook is like learning a language, right? At first, you're kind of putting it together, but then it becomes second nature.
Right.
And you have a book of, you know, very well-defined recipes. Mm-hmm. But, you know, once you learn a language, you have that technique. You don't think, you know, I'm making subject, you know, verb, predicate. I'm just using these techniques in order to, you know, come up with what I want to say.
Right.
What techniques in Korean cooking, you know, do you begin to assimilate after cooking Korean for a while? What are the basic skills that
you get really good at peeling garlic because that gets used in everything, and a lot of Korean cooking is. The cooking part is doesn't take that long. It's the chopping and slicing and getting preparing things. So it's just a matter of, you know, getting good, having a sharp knife, having a good sharp knife, because most people's knives are not sharp. And actually in Korean culture, traditionally, it's actually bad to have sharp knives. But it's like I say, no, forget tradition. You got to have a sharp knife if you want to cook well. And I think it's, you know, just getting used to cutting things fast. And that's it, I guess, I could think of.
A lot of foreigners, also a lot of young people, found out, oddly enough, about Korean food via TV dramas. Particularly, you know, there was this one huge success, Tae Jong-un, which I think is called Jewel in the Palace. Jewel in the Palace, historical TV drama, and then now we have Le Grand Chef.
Yes.
So I was interested in what you thought. Have you seen these TV shows?
I've seen some of them when I was last in Korea. I was staying with my great aunt, and every morning she couldn't do her housework because she had to watch the dramas, and she's like, "Oh, crying," and I'm like, "Why are you crying?" "Oh, every morning I cry, and then I have to do the dishes," you know. So I would watch some of them. I can't really get into the historical dramas as much because they speak in old Korean.
Right, yeah.
And it's like old English, but different. And I'm like, oh, it's so stylized. But I actually saw them film some of it.
Oh, really?
And it's a good way of learning Korea's history, I think.
Could you maybe explain the traditional Korean table?
Oh, okay.
People go to a Korean restaurant and they see all these bowls. And a typical meal consist of?
Sure. I'll break it down. So when you have a Korean meal, you always have rice. Everybody gets their own individual bowl. And then you get either soup or like some kind of liquid. And then there's usually a main dish. So it could be a fish. It could be a chicken or some beef. And then a bunch of side dishes. So in a royal meal, they'll have 21 tiny little side dishes, but since you know, most of us don't make royal meals at home, we do. In traditional culture, we like to have things in odd numbers, so it's because it's better luck. So you'll have five dishes or seven or nine. So it's better to keep it that way, just for good luck. And so it's usually whatever seasonal vegetables is around or the seafood that's been salted, some kind of kimchi. You know, you have to have a little something spicy. And then that's it.
And some of the utensils.
Like, oh, okay. Koreans don't eat their rice with the chopsticks. We actually have metal chopsticks and a spoon, and we always use a spoon to eat the rice. And the metal chopsticks is because back in the old days, they used to use silver chopsticks for the royalty to make sure that there wasn't any poison in the food. Mm-hmm. So because the silver would tarnish. And so the commoners, you know, copied the royalty and got, you know, used metal chopsticks as well. And you just, you know, reach over and grab everything with your chopsticks and eat the rice and the soup with your spoon.
We haven't spoken much about your travel writing. I was wondering if you, how do you connect your food writing with your travel? Is that something you ever considered doing, a travel book
that's
also, you know, like maybe a trip to Korea that would also be a sort of a gastronomic trip through the various specialties according to the province?
Right.
The province.
Yeah, I pitched a regional Korean cookbook to my publisher and they said, I don't know if there's a market for it. So I don't know if... So yeah, I'll still see if someone would, you know, publish it. But when I was in Korea, I was actually writing The Farmer's Guide the same time I was writing the cookbook. Mm-hmm. So I was able to take the pictures that are in the book so that there's some travel photos in there as well. But I was really taken by how regional the food is because each area has their own specialty and they're very proud about that. Or this town is known for this. And it's like, oh, this town is known for this special cut of pork. Or this town is known for... So like everybody has their own special way of making something. And I thought, oh, this is so great. I love that. And I loved going around eating everything. So I would love to be able to do a regional cookbook next.
Is that why Korean restaurants are kind of like that as well? I mean, it seems like the good Korean restaurants, it's because they have one specialty. Like have really good sundubu. Or is it because of that? It's like the specialty of the town and they tend to repeat, reproduce that kind of pattern?
I think so, because if you travel around Korea, people specialize in one thing and they go, okay, we do noodles well, and this is a special kind of noodle with green tea in it, or this is, you know, a certain kind of buckwheat, and that's, we do buckwheat, or we grow rice here, so our, you know, meal is based on rice. And so the way restaurants evolved in Korea has, you know, just been about like, we make one dish well, and we don't care about anything else. So if you want, because people will say, oh, what is a good place to get Korean food? And I'm like, well, what do you want? Do you want meat? Do you want noodles? Do you want this? And so each restaurant will specialize in one thing. And I think because each region specializes in one, something as well.
Do you have personal preferences then? So for one region and another, which means you would have personal preferences for a particular, I suppose.
The people from Jeollado, you know, the Jeolla province, say they're
down south.
They have the south. I'm going to say the wrong direction.
Yeah, I'm always confused too, depending on where you're looking.
If you're looking at a map, it's southwest. I think I'm probably going to say it wrong, but people from Jeollado say we make the best food, and so I thought, okay, I'm going to have to try it. So when I went there, I thought, they really do make the best food. And it's not because, you know, like, it's not because they have more, because you can go to certain other areas of Korea and they'll have more banchan, you know, more of the side dishes, and the table will be full and it's very impressive. They'll only have a few dishes, but they do it really well. And it's like a little bit more complexity of flavor. And I think I agree with them. I was like, okay, you're right. You guys do make the best food.
So Jeolla, best province when it comes to food?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, maybe I should go. What about Gyeongsang? What do you think about Gyeongsang?
Gyeongsang, okay. Gyeongsangdo?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But because, well, that's where the sort of what they call the rice basket of Korea is.
Right, exactly.
And so there a lot of rice and grains are grown there because that's where the plains are between all the mountains. But I think... because of the royal food and royal food developed in that region. Mm-hmm. But royal food is not known for big flavors because royalty wasn't supposed to eat anything spicy. Mm-hmm. They weren't supposed to, you know, get tan or work in the field. You know, there's all this stuff that went on with the royalty. So the food is a lot more subtle. Uh-huh. And I like the bold flavors, I think.
So when people go and they get your cookbook, right, what are the let's say, the five things that they must try. Which page do you turn to first?
Five.
Let's describe these dishes.
Okay. Let's see. There's the bibimguksu, which is the mixed noodle that's on the cover. And that's actually really easy to make. Because you boil the noodles, and it's somen, so it's a very, very thin noodle, so it cooks very fast. And you just, you know, take a mandolin and shred the vegetables, saute it, throw it in a, you know, bowl with a little bit of seasoning, and then you just toss it, and it's ready. And that's easy. You know, you could have a meal in 15 minutes.
And this is a typical dish for?
It's good for the summertime, I think, because you don't want to slave over a stove, and you could eat a noodle dish cold. So I think that's a good one for summer. Mm-hmm. And I really like the skewered beef recipe because, you know, barbecue is good. And there's a good texture sort of contrast between the beef that's been marinated and the rice cakes. And so you get a little chewy, and then you get the beef and then, you know, the green onion and all of that. So I think that mixes well together. And what's a good dish? The thing that I always make, which is very, very easy, is the tofu dish, because I always have tofu in the house. I always have garlic. I always have green onion. And I thought, oh, I could just make this really easily. And that takes no time. And you get a good crispy texture of the tofu on the outside, and then it's a little soft on the inside, so you get a good mix of flavors as well. I'm trying to remember what recipes I have in the book. Let me see. Okay. I would say any of the pancakes are easy because you just make a batter, you throw everything in a bowl, and then you just cook it. So it's good for, you could just double the recipe or triple it or quadruple it for how many people you're cooking. And if you're like my family, you end up cooking for like 50 people and it takes you 3 hours, but that's another story.
And that's something that you could freeze.
You could freeze it, and then you can just reheat it, so that makes it easy. And also you could do it in small batches or big batches. It's just like making pancakes. You know, you can make small batch of pancakes, or you could cook, you know, for our army, so it depends on you. And I really like the spicy stewed mussels, but I really like mussels. If you get fresh mussels, you know, for a time of year, usually in the spring, when they're, you know, fishing them out of the ocean. And the spiciness, you know, I think is a good complement to the mussels.
We mentioned a little bit about royal food. But when I'm in Korea, my favorite thing is street food.
Yes, me too.
And I see you have the tteokbokki recipe here. And maybe we could talk a little about, you know,
street food
and how to eat it and what it's like.
Maybe the most extreme form of street food, because it's interesting to have a discussion with a chef, a conversation with a chef about the most bizarre aspect of Korean food as well.
I love street food. I mean, I've gone and just eaten all day on just street food, just walking around, seeing what smells good or looks good and just buying it and eating on the street. But like tteokbokki, for instance, is a street food. There's actually an entire street dedicated in Seoul just for tteokbokki. And you just, the whole street is lined left and right down the way with tteokbokki. And you're just like, okay, you just pick one. And
we should explain that these
maybe
are
tteokbokki. Maybe explain what tteokbokki is for people.
Tteokbokki is made from what they call, if you look at the package, it'll say rice cake sticks. And they look like cylindrical rice cakes that are small. And it's best to get it fresh, but sometimes you could get it frozen. And if you get it frozen, you have to soak it in water to soften it up before you cook it. And then it's sauteed with, you know, vegetables and chili paste and soy sauce and onion and garlic. And sometimes people put ramen in it, depending on, you know, the lumpia, you know, sort of.
I like that version.
Yeah. If you do it, you get it on the street, they put ramen in it. And so that's what that is. And, you know, it's kind of a street food. You could have it in a sit-down place, but generally people are like walking around eating it on the street. And there's lots of different kinds of street food. And I grew up eating it because my dad actually loves eating street food. And he used to take us to go eat crazy things like roasted sparrow. And, you know, you just go and you're like,
that's what
you know,
I wanted
to. Yeah, my dad is very, my dad's a very adventurous eater. And, I've eaten some crazy, crazy things because of him as a little kid. And he wouldn't tell us what it was until we finished it. So I'm like, what's that? And he's like, I'll tell you after you eat it. And I'm like, okay. And he's actually taken us to eat live squid. So nothing like eating food that's moving. just, you know. There's also bondegi, which is the casing of silkworms. And it sounds disgusting, but it really is not. It's actually kind of nutty and flavorful. And it's not actually the silkworms themselves. It's just the outside part of it. So it's much better than eating grasshopper. Or centipede,
yeah. Which you can also do.
And they also sell millipedes as medicinal things. You don't eat it for fun. You eat it because you're sick. But
and you don't have the recipes for that.
No, I don't have the recipes for millipedes or silkworm casings in my book, unfortunately. But you can't really get silkworm casings in America. Mm. You could get it in cans, and I don't think the canned stuff is as good.
What would you say, especially for restaurant food, about the tension between preserving Korean cuisine and making it more accessible?
Yeah, I think there's a push and pull with, you know, the traditional culture and modernizing Korea. So it's sort of like, oh, we want to make it accessible to everybody, but then we don't want to lose our sort of authenticity and sort of the tradition and the history. But then can you do both, you know, in a way? And I think yes and no, you know, in some ways you can, in some ways you can't. And I mean, like if you eat at a Korean restaurant, people will always complain. You know, if you eat in America, be like, oh, it's too sweet. They Americanized it. You know, it's always like, oh, they made that for the American palate. It's not really Korean because it's too this or too this. And I think in some ways it's true, but, you know, Korean food isn't really, you know, in some ways, if you think about it, like garlic and chili peppers aren't Korean. You know, they came from the New World and it had to be brought and then it got incorporated into the food. So I think food, like language and like culture, ends up changing. It's just people want to complain about it
I mean, it seems that over the time, you know, Korea has been very accepting of flavors in, from other
flavors.
Korea started with, I mean, the basic grain wasn't even rice, you know, at the beginning, like, you know, thousands of years ago, because, you know, rice wasn't grown there. It was more, you know, different other grains. And then rice was introduced, and then it was like, then it became the staple. And then, so I think because Korea has so many outside influences because of its situation geographically, and it gets influences from so many different places, in a way, you know, that's why it was called the Hermit Kingdom for a while, because Koreans felt like, oh, we want to preserve our culture and our language and our food and all of that. And, but we can't help but change because that's just the way things are.
So it's more of a defensive stance, perhaps. On
yeah,
side of
because anything. Korea has been attacked so many times. If you look in Korean history, thousands of years, it's all about wars. It's like, it's been attacked by these people and it's been attacked by these. The Mongolians came in. Oh, the Chinese came in. No, the Japanese. And then so it's sort of like, after a while, it was just like, we just want to preserve our culture. And I think that's it's just ingrained in our culture is to do that with everything, including the food.
What do you see as the quintessential Korean dish? And people would say bulgogi, typically when they give you, like, for the first time, they do a food festival. I don't know. I'm not sure I can quote places, but okay, let's say the UN. typically, they're going to give you bulgogi, they're going to give you japchae, and they're going to give you bacheon. That's what they do.
Right. Do you
agree with that vision?
I think the real Korean food, I mean, other than rice, because you know, rice is synonymous with meal in Korean language, is kimchi, because kimchi is really Korean. You don't find it anywhere else in the world. And that's what it is. And if you can eat kimchi, you could eat any kind of Korean food, I think. I don't think, you know. In some ways, I think people serve bulgogi or japchae or whatever, things like that, because it's safe. It's not spicy. It's not going to offend you. So it's sort of like, oh, you know, nobody doesn't not like meat, you know, unless you're a vegetarian. But so people are like, oh, it's safe. So it's like, we'll give them that to start with. Work their way up to the spicy things, you know.
You know, last time we had that program, after we had that program at the Korean table, I promised myself I would force whoever would be next not to cook, not to make either chapchae or bulgogi or
pacha.
I was like, no, come on.
We have so many other dishes that are great that people don't know about.
We should also tell people that in your book, you know, there are many different types of kimchi, and in your book, you have some of the major categories, right? The normal kimchi that we think of, the cabbage.
Mm-hmm. Right. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
There's right. You have the cucumber, which is really refreshing.
Right. Great for the summertime.
Great for the summertime. Yeah.
There's something like, I can't remember the exact number, but according to the Korean Food Council or whatever, they counted over 187 different varieties of kimchi, and it's like, I don't even know how to make 187 different varieties, mm-hmm. but there are some, you know, the ones that people think of normally are is the traditional Napa cabbage kimchi. That's what people think of when they think of kimchi. But then there's so many other different kinds made from, you know, if it's a vegetable and you could pickle it, it'll be made into kimchi. Mm-hmm. And Koreans have done it.
And you also have a recipe for water kimchi, uh-huh. which probably doesn't look like what normal people, you know, what people would normally associate with kimchi. Right.
There's nothing red in it. You know, there's no chili. It's not hot. Mm-hmm. But water kimchi, I think, was developed in the northern part of Korea. And it's sometimes served with the liquid of the water kimchi is served with noodles. Mm-hmm. So that you get like what they call dongchimi kimchi sometimes, or dongchimi guksu. But it's a different type of kimchi, but it's still pickling and saving the vegetables. That's the basic, you know, idea of kimchi, is to be able to save the vegetables for the wintertime.
Interesting. So perhaps in conclusion, unless you have other questions, what would you say to the gourmet of, how could I put it, of goodwill but bad faith, who would like to try Korean food but doesn't know and is a little defiant? You know how lots of people are very wary of foods they don't know, and mm-hmm. I do say foods in in that sense. What would you say to the first time customer, somebody who's like, oh, maybe not, it looks I don't know, what would you say to her?
I think the safest thing to start with is kalbi, because mm-hmm. it's beef. It's grilled, it's easy, it's tasty, and it doesn't have anything that's unusual. It's made with, you know, sesame oil and garlic and a little bit of sugar, soy sauce. That's it, you know, and you grill it up. And so people find that a very easy way to, you know, ease your way into Korean food. But I think a lot of the dishes that I include in my book are not unusual. Mm-hmm. You know, like I don't have this, you know, the silkworm casings or things that like even Koreans don't want to eat. So, and a lot of the recipes include just, you know, ingredients that you could find in a regular market. You don't have to go to a specialty store. You know, there's a few things that you might have to go to a Korean store for. Mm-hmm. But in general, you can find it at a regular grocery store and you could just try it at home. Mm-hmm. So I think everyone should try it.
The opinions expressed in the preceding program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Korea Society, its staff, management, or sponsors.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Korea Society. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Visit www.koreasociety.org for more information about memberships and to learn more about the programs available at the Korea Society.